Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing possibility that the confrontation between Russia and Ukraine could turn into a war, and get an analysis of Putin's greatest vulnerability, and that is from banks, not tanks. The largest foreign investor in Russia up until 2005, Bill Browder, the chief executive and founder of Hermitage Capital, joins us to discuss the billions Putin and his cronies have stolen and parked abroad, palatial wealth which, by comparison, makes the just-deposed Yanukovych look like a minor thief. Browder's lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, was murdered by the Putin regime, and we'll look into whether the 2002 U.S. law, the Sergei Magnitsky Rule of Law Accountability Act, could be applied to Putin. Then we will speak with a former CIA veteran, Melvin Goodman, about Senator Feinstein's powerful speech condemning the CIA for intimidating the Senate Intelligence Committee she heads and accusing the agency of possibly spying on her Senate staffers. We'll discuss the extraordinary efforts the CIA is making to suppress the 6,000-page report on the Bush-Cheney era's secret torture and rendition program and assess whether this report will see the light of day, given the apparent resolve displayed by Senator Feinstein Tuesday, who up until now has appeared to have had a cozy relationship with the intelligence community she oversees. Then finally, we will look into an editorial in Tuesday's New York Times, "The Democrats Stand Up to the Kochs," and discuss how Democrats in the U.S. Senate are starting to fight back against the Koch brothers' efforts to buy a Senate led by Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, who has promised his benefactors that he will, quote, be the leader of the forces that take on the war on coal, clearing the way for the Kochs to pollute at will. Beverly Gage, a professor of history at Yale University and author of The Day Wall Street Exploded, A Story of America in the First Age of Terror, joins us to discuss how much the oligarchs in the New Gilded Age are getting off lightly. And joining us now is Bill Browder, chief executive and founder of Hermitage Capital Markets. He was the largest foreign investor in Russia until November of 2005, when he was suddenly denied entry into the country and declared a threat to national security by the Russian government for exposing corruption. Since 2009, when his lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, died in a Russian prison after uncovering a $230 million fraud committed by Russian government officials, he has been leading a global campaign to expose the corruption and human rights abuses endemic in Russia. As a result of his campaign, the Sergei Magnitsky Rule of Law Accountability Act was signed into U.S. law in 2012, imposing visa bans and asset freezes on certain officials involved in Magnitsky's death. Browder is currently working to have similar legislation passed across the European Union as a means to seek justice for Magnitsky and fight government-backed corruption in Russia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Browder.
Thank you very much.
And it does appear that Vladimir Putin's warning to the oligarchs back in 2012 that they should bring their assets back from outside Russia because it makes them too vulnerable to moves by foreign governments. It's looking as if now that is both prophetic and Putin did not listen to the oligarchs in terms of making this move into Crimea.
Well, I think that there's actually a much bigger story here, which is sort of the elephant in the room, which hasn't been picked up by very many people, which is that Putin, what you have to understand about Putin is that he doesn't run the country like a normal leader for the benefit of the people. He runs what I would describe as probably the most well-developed kleptocracy in the world, where he and the guys around him steal lots and lots of money as the main purpose of running the country. And so he's stolen a lot of money, and he's now in this strange position where he really can't enjoy the money because if at any point he gets kicked out, he'll be kicked out like Yanukovych, where they're all just freeze his assets around the world. And so I believe that the war that he's just started is not about Ukraine. It's about creating a distraction so people don't get kick him out for being such a kleptocrat. So this is a personal survival strategy for Vladimir Putin to keep people's mind off of what's really going on, which is all the money for the country went to him and his cronies and not to the people.
So I thought that he was a little less brazen than Yanukovych, that he regulated the oligarchs, but you're saying he shakes them down like...
Oh, my God. I think you're wrong. Yanukovych is a sort of a bit player compared to Putin. When the Putin regime falls, we can see his palaces. It'll make Yanukovych look like a nobody. I mean, the stuff that Putin's got. I mean, this is major league corruption and major league palaces and huge money spent all over the place on Putin's personal possessions, not just in Russia, but in different countries in Western Europe, and probably even in America.
And presumably through cutouts in the West.
Yeah, nothing is registered in his name. It's registered into the name of these big oligarchs. So when you see these oligarchs and you see them on the Forbes rich list, their wealth isn't what's being reported. Their wealth is probably much less because they're holding, on behalf of Putin and on behalf of other senior Russian government officials, houses and boats and various airplanes, bank accounts and various other things. And so when the West is going to go after Putin and his cronies, they'll eventually find that stuff in the accounts of oligarchs. And so they have good reason to be scared because all their money is intermingled.
So my understanding is that clearly Putin leaned on Yanukovych to reverse the EU deal and to join Russia. And one of the subtexts that I understand from that was that the EU required Ukraine to open up the books on its dealings with Gazprom. And I take it that Gazprom is Putin's slush fund. Was that a factor in starting this crisis?
Well, I don't know that specific story, but I can imagine that it's actually a much broader thing, which is that Russia needs this, what they call the Eurasian Union, where they wanted to create their own sort of version of the European Union with Ukraine and Belarus and Kazakhstan and Armenia and so on and so forth, and Ukraine would have been a big part of that, and when Ukraine was leaning towards Europe, it was sort of I think it was more of a reputational slap in Putin's face than anything else, that somehow the EU was going to win. Putin sees everything as a zero sum game. And if Europe was going to get it, if Europe somehow created some connection with Ukraine, then somehow that would make Russia much worse off. But I don't think that anyone anywhere could have imagined that by Putin playing this sort of manipulative game of trying to buy Yanukovych in this deal, that it would lead to a revolution and then an invasion. I don't think even the Russians probably could have predicted that. I think this thing has just spun so far out of control that nobody, nobody could have imagined this.
Again, I'm speaking with Bill Barada, who's the chief executive and founder of Hermitage Capital Markets. He was the largest foreign investor in Russia until November 2005, when he was suddenly denied entry to the country and declared a threat to national security by Russian government officials for exposing corruption. Since then, he's been leading a global campaign to expose the corruption and human rights abuses endemic in Russia. And as a result of his campaign, the Sergei Magnitsky Rule of Law Accountability Act was signed into U.S. law in 2012, imposing visa bans and asset freezes on certain officials. So is it possible then, Bill Browder, that this whole misadventure on Putin's part could blow up in his face?
Well, I think it's extremely possible. I mean, the other thing you need to understand about Putin is that he's not a strategist, he's a tactician, which means that he hasn't thought through, like the famous chess players of the world think, eight moves ahead. He's not thinking eight moves ahead. He's thinking one or two moves ahead. And I don't think he knows how this thing is going to play itself out, and I don't think anyone really knows. And I think that he's really overstepped because Russia... This is not Russia from 30 years ago. Russia may have a lot of money in the bank, but they don't have a strong army. They're not in a position to go around fighting big wars. And what they're banking on right now is that the West will effectively do nothing when they take over Crimea and possibly take over Eastern Ukraine. That's what Putin is banking on. If he was actually, if someone calls his bluff here, he's got a pretty weak hand. And so, I don't think he knows, and I don't think the West knows how this thing's going to play. And I mean, personally, when I lived in Russia, I've actually played poker with oligarchs, and it's the most interesting experience I've ever had because they bluff every hand. It's very easy to play poker with oligarchs because all you have to do is stay in the hand. When you've got a good hand, they try to bluff you, and then they lose. And Putin's got a weak hand. He's bluffing everybody. Everybody is behaving like he's running some type of superpower, but he's got a very weak army, and he's got a very weak situation all around. And so who knows how it's going to play itself out, but it could easily end up where he's overplayed his hand and not good things happen to him.
Well, of course, that was often said during the Cold War, that the Americans play poker and the Russians play chess. But in this case, if he has so much money parked abroad, then he is as vulnerable as any of the oligarchs, as you've pointed out, because the money is commingled. Would that deter him? Because one of the fears that I have is that as bad as Putin is, since he's eradicated all political opposition and basically killed politics in Russia, could we end up with someone worse?
Well, at the moment, I don't see anybody worse than Putin. I mean, here's a man who's gone and invaded a peaceful neighbor. How could you get worse than that? I mean, you know, he's been running an authoritarian regime. He was personally was involved in the cover up of a murder of my lawyer. You know, he's an evil man. I certainly wouldn't advise anybody to support him because the next guy is going to be worse. That doesn't make any sense.
Well, then what makes sense, surely, is to expose him for who he is. It doesn't do anybody any good to pretend. I mean, that was one of the problems that Chamberlain had in Munich with Hitler, was that Chamberlain came out of that old school of the British gentleman diplomacy, and he simply didn't know that he was negotiating with a gangster.
Well, and this is exactly what Vladimir Putin is, and there's been a policy in the United States for the last 6 or so years called the reset policy with Russia, where everybody wanted to effectively appease Russia. And I've been arguing against it, saying that you know, these people are criminals. This is a mafia country, and you can't appease mafia gangsters. And this invasion of Ukraine has just showed the whole world how with this reset policy really was a complete and utter naive failure of foreign policy from the United States standpoint. And now we've got to catch up. We've got to do something. Now the good news is that because Putin he's a man of money, and he's a man about money, we have a much different type of leverage than we had during the Soviet days. All you have to do is find his money and freeze his money, and you've created you've got him right where it counts.
So is that in the cards, do you think? I mean, why do we not, as I say, I don't understand why we don't call a spade a spade. And, you know, one of the things that gangsters always crave for is respect. And we just give him respect for free, don't we?
Well, we have been, but I think that I think he's created a situation where it makes it now impossible to do that. I mean, the language that's come out of the U.S. government in the last few days and come out of the British Foreign Office and various other places shows that nobody is doing that anymore. Now, the question is, how tough are the sanctions against Putin and Russia going forward? And I will be very disappointed if there's not serious asset freezes and visa bans of Russian officials. But from what I can tell, that is what they're discussing. And I would argue that may be just enough to at least stop them from any further territorial ambition. It may not be that they're going to, it surely will be that Russia's not going to retreat from Crimea, but if you slap on hardcore financial asset freezes and visa sanctions, it may be just enough to prevent them from doing anything worse.
Well, but how do you think, though, this is playing inside Russia itself? Because there's some polls indicating that there's a certain amount of disquiet on the part of the majority of Russians about the possibility of shedding blood with Russians and Ukrainians shooting at each other. There's a great deal of historical, cultural, and familial ties between these two countries. On the other hand, you can see the propaganda machine is demonizing, making it seem like the entire new government in Kiev are a bunch of Nazis and anti-Semites, when in fact the prime minister of this new government is Jewish. And that's what's disturbing about the possibility of, it's the same MO they used in Crimea, which is to create this imaginary pogrom against Russians in order to liberate Russians. And now they're saying the same thing about eastern Ukraine, that people there, Russian-speaking people, are being oppressed. So it's kind of scary that they could even go further, or Putin could even go further. But my understanding is that this is not necessarily going to sit well with the Russian people once Ukrainians and Russians start spilling blood.
I wish that that were true, and I wish that there was a civil society in Russia which could contain the ambitions of Putin, but unfortunately there isn't. And it doesn't really matter to Putin or to Russia what the people think, because they don't really have an opportunity to express themselves. This is an authoritarian regime. The one thing I would point out is that Putin was able to become elected. He became the president back in year 2000 by starting a war. He started a war against the Chechens. He demonized the Chechens and then went in and basically leveled Chechnya and drove away lots and lots of people, killed lots and lots of people. And on the back of the fervor of that war, he became the president. And his presidency in the last 2 years has been substantially weakened by the corruption. And he needed this war. He needed this distraction to sort of solidify his base. And I would argue that once you get involved in a full-scale war, people don't really, there is no opposition. And I think that that's what he's up to right now, to basically prevent himself from getting kicked out of office. And so I don't see that, that public opinion in Russia is going to do anything that will dissuade him. And in fact, I would imagine that as this thing escalates, people have no choice but to sort of stand behind their president in a war, whether it's with their cousins in Ukraine or with somebody else.
Well, of course, when we went into Iraq, you know, the press and the public were behind George W. Bush's monstrous mistake. So we're not immune from that kind of jingoism. And I imagine it will also be the case in Russia. But you, Bill Browder, were pointing out earlier that the Russian military is not what it used to be. So how long before they get – I talked to a defense analyst who writes for Novaya Gazeta, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer. He's one of the – you know, Novaya Gazeta is one of the last pieces of the press that Putin doesn't control. And he suggested that it could get really ugly for the Russians.
Well, I think it could. If you go back and we have one data point to analyze, which was the war with Georgia. In 2008, Russia invaded Georgia, which is a tiny little country. It's a country of just a few million people. And they really had a hard time getting themselves organized and defeating the Georgians, which was effectively a ragtag army of very few people with very little equipment. Ukraine is not the same thing at all. Ukraine is a country with 55 million people and a real army. It may not be as big as the Russian army, but it's a real army. And the Ukrainians will be protecting their own country, whereas you have a bunch of demoralized Russian soldiers that don't particularly want to be firing on their neighbors in the first place. The equipment might be a little bit more modern on the Russian side than the Ukrainian side, but it's not a completely unfair fight. I don't think Putin really wants to go to war. He wants to bluff his way into Ukraine and stop there. I don't think that he would value a bloody fight, but I think he's ready for it if that's what it takes. And I don't think he minds, because it's not a democracy, he's not going to lose his position as president if he has, you know, tens of thousands of soldiers dying. It's not the same thing as it is in America.
Well, Bill Browder, you were, of course, featured recently in a 60 Minutes piece about your lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, who was tortured and died in a prison for exposing the theft of $230 million by Russian government officials. Is it therefore possible then to expand the Sergei Magnitsky Rule of Law Accountability Act to cover Putin at a certain point if this thing... I suspect you're quite correct that Putin doesn't want a war, but my sense is it could happen because it's such a tense situation. But what about that idea? Because at the end of the day, it seems to me that when you're dealing with a gangster, the only thing that is going to get to him is that he might lose all of that money that he's assiduously stashed away around the world.
Indeed, and I think so. I agree with you. I think that there's a real probability of war. It could happen at any moment. I agree with you that this guy is all about money, and he cares about his money, and that is the biggest leverage we have. It's the famous chess player and human rights activist Garry Kasparov says, "Let's hit them in the bank." We can use banks instead of tanks, and I agree with that. And the Sergei Magnitsky Rule of Law Accountability Act, which was named after my murdered lawyer Sergei Magnitsky, was a policy tool that was defined for this era. This is the new technology for global. It's going after global kleptocrats by freezing their assets and banning their visas. And it's a piece of law on the books in the United States. It doesn't just apply to Sergei Magnitsky. It applies to all other Russian human rights abusers. and it's on the books, ready to go, to be applied and implemented to the people who are involved in this invasion of Ukraine. And Vladimir Putin is the number one guy on that list, and there's many others. And I think that either the Magnitsky Act itself or some version of it will eventually be the tool that's going to be used, and probably used relatively soon against the Russians if they don't back down.
Well, just in closing, to return to the notion that you could end up with something worse than Putin, which you, I think, fairly effectively argued that there couldn't be anything worse than Putin. But the question still remains is that since he's destroyed Russian democracy and politics and eradicated it effectively, is there anything that could, you know, rise up, any green shoots, any hope here in terms of, because I understand within Moscow itself, the elite don't like Putin. The Narod, that are subject to his propaganda and out in the middle of the country, seem to support him, but he doesn't seem to have a lot of support in his hometown, or where he's situated, I should say. His hometown, of course, is Leningrad, I believe. Or St. Petersburg.
St. Petersburg. Well, I think that there's all sorts of possibilities of people coming in and doing the job. You know, Ukraine was a far more democratic country, even with Yanukovych, than Russia. But, you know, they were quickly able to assemble a new interim government, which at first glance seems to be quite responsible and international and thoughtful. And I don't see any reason why, if Putin were to be deposed, that Russia couldn't muster up its own proper replacement for this criminal regime, the assumption that somebody worse is going to come along, I think, is a very pessimistic way to view politics, and I don't think anyone at this point can imagine anyone worse coming along. And I know quite a few opposition politicians in Russia who would be a hell of a lot better, I hope and pray that this menace, Vladimir Putin, will eventually find his way into the International Criminal Court in The Hague and not running Russia.
Well, Bill Browder, I thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Bill Browder, who's the chief executive and founder of Hermitage Capital Markets. He was the largest foreign investor in Russia until November 2005, when he was suddenly denied entry to the country and declared a threat to national security by the Russian government for exposing corruption. Since 2009, when his lawyer Sergei Magnitsky died in a Russian prison after uncovering a $230 million fraud committed by Russian government officials, he's been leading a global campaign to expose the corruption and human rights abuses endemic in Russia. As a result of this campaign, the Sergei Magnitsky Rule of Law Accountability Act was signed into U.S. law in 2012, imposing visa bans and asset freezes on certain officials involved in the Magnitsky death. Browder is currently working to have similar legislation passed across the European Union as a means to seek justice for Magnitsky and to fight government-backed corruption in Russia. We're going to take a brief station break and be looking into Senator Feinstein's powerful speech condemning the CIA.
What a crime! In the old time, in the old time, in the old time, it was not a crime! Not a crime! Not a crime!
But they beg you away my name. I got one hell of a job, we're born for the U.S. of A. Got the
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Melvin Goodman, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year government career included service at the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and the U.S. Army. In 1991, he's one of three former CIA officials to testify before the Senate against the nomination of Robert Gates as director of Central Intelligence on the grounds that he had slanted intelligence to suit policy. He's the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, and his latest book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Melvin Goodman.
Hello, Ian. Good to be with you again.
And it looks as if the CIA and the Oversight Committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee, are at loggerheads here, trading accusations and denials. Senator Feinstein, the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, on Tuesday has alleged that the CIA was trying to intimidate Congress and may have broken the law in spying on Senate staffers, in effect hacking into their work. This is pretty unusual, isn't it?
I think it's extremely unusual. It may even be unprecedented in terms of the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Dianne Feinstein, who has not been a strong chairman, by the way, willing to take on the CIA director on this issue of the torture report, interrogation report, and what the CIA really thinks about that report, because it turns out there's two CIA views. The Panetta report seems to correspond with what the Senate was saying, and then a later report done under Brennan is challenging the Senate's views on whether the torture was done and whether it was effective. So this could get very ugly, and the fact that the Justice Department is investigating both claims, the CIA's claim that the Senate operated maybe illegally looking at files that they weren't permitted to look at, and then whether or not the CIA was doing its own bit of sleuthing in looking at what the Senate Intelligence Committee was really up to.
But this 6,300-page report, which has cost the taxpayer $40 million and has been in the work for years, is being held up by the CIA, and particularly by Brennan. Is that the situation?
Even though Brennan testified when he was confirmed that he believed in greater transparency, he's playing the same games that other CIA directors have played. And obviously, they've got a very sticky wicket on this one. And the Senate is challenging everything the CIA has said about torture, about renditions, about erroneous renditions, about innocent people who were tortured. And I think the Senate must know how ugly and sadistic the torture activities were. And I think this was behind the destruction of the torture tapes as well. The CIA operative Jose Rodriguez, who destroyed 92 different torture tapes and was never held to account for it. So this is very nasty business. And fortunately, there are a couple senators led by Senator Mark Udall who's leading the fight, and I think holding Feinstein's feet to the fire and pressing the case against the CIA.
But presumably Senator Feinstein's got to stick up for her own staff, right? That's what it comes down to.
I think what we're seeing are some very stubborn members of the committee led by Udall and Wyden and Heinrich of New Mexico are trying to hold her feet to the fire because she has not been a vigorous watchdog of the CIA. But here, yes, I think she has to defend a 6,000-page report that took several years to prepare. And it's interesting to me that John Brennan, the CIA director, is saying that they didn't tap into the computers of the Senate Investigating Committee, but somehow they did learn about the Senate's access to a sensitive internal report. So obviously intelligence was collected against the committee. And I saw this happen in 1991 when I was testifying against Gates, the CIA director. There was a congressional liaison assigned to the Senate Intelligence Committee, but he was reporting back to the White House the very sensitive politics of the committee during the hearings. And I imagine there's been some penetration of the Senate committee staff by CIA figures.
Well, I remember in the early days of the committee, the Oversight Committee that came out of the Church hearings, you know, when Bill Colby sort of, you know, did endless testimony about uncovering all of the misdeeds and the so-called crown jewels of the CIA that led to an enormous amount of outrage and this whole regime that you have with the House and Senate Select Intelligence Committees. But I recall that after a while, there was a joke at the CIA that they referred to the committees as the mushroom farms, that we keep them in the dark and now and again throw manure on them?
Well, that wasn't true in the first 15 years. I thought from the mid-70s when the committees were created at the Senate and the House, these were pretty active, energetic committees that were bipartisan. There were real luminaries in the Senate who were placed on these committees. But once David Boren resigned, the committee chairman from 1992, once he resigned from the Senate and went out to Oklahoma to be president of the University of Oklahoma, these committees have gotten very partisan under both Republicans like Pat Roberts and Democrats such as Dianne Feinstein. But I think this issue could be a real rallying cry because Lindsey Graham is now involved and is defending the committee. Carl Levin, who's an ex officio member of the committee, is defending the committee. And I think the activity of Udall and Wyden and others is going to force Dianne Feinstein to be very active against essentially a CIA penetration of the Oversight Committee. So how can you claim that you have a functioning democracy that's conducting oversight of a secret intelligence organization when the intelligence organization has actually penetrated the committee that's responsible for investigating it? So Brennan, I think, is in a real sticky mess because he doesn't have a lot of credibility with people anyway. That's why I fought him, and so did others as CIA director, because he's so close to the politics of the situation. This was true when he was close to Tenet, and they were conducting torture and abuse, which he never criticized, even though he claims he did. He never did. And now I think he's so close to Obama, he's been very protective of the drones of targeted assassinations. And now I think he's in a real bind on this torture report because it indicates the CIA was even lying to the Congress about what it was conducting in terms of torture and abuse. And more importantly, did it learn anything from it? The Senate report concludes that very little was learned, if anything. And I think there's an internal report, the so-called Panetta Review, that corroborates the Senate study.
Well, I recently interviewed Glenn Carl, who was a part of the CIA program working at a black site where they were using in torture on a suspect who was supposed to be number three in al-Qaeda. And Glenn learned right away that this guy was completely innocent. And he would keep going back to headquarters and saying, the guy is innocent. There's just, we shouldn't be doing this. And headquarters, I guess it was Rodriguez, would say, no, that's how they're trained. They're clever. You know, you got to ramp up the and enhance the interrogation even further. And eventually this poor guy was kept in solitary cell, rotting away for years and years and years. And until Obama came in, one of the first things Obama did was release this guy, who turned out to be innocent all along.
Well, the German who was rendered, or more accurately called kidnapped in Macedonia and sent to Afghanistan, the CIA knew immediately that this was an erroneous rendition, but they wouldn't release him until Condoleezza Rice, who was the national security advisor at the time, interfered and told George Tenet this person had to be released immediately. And frankly, I think the only reason why that happened is because he was a German citizen. If he had been a Middle Eastern citizen, he could still be in an Afghan jail somewhere or in Guantanamo. And Rodriguez himself, since you mentioned Rodriguez, he's the one who destroyed 92 different videotapes of torture and abuse because they would have revealed the sadistic nature of this torture. So I think Rodriguez determined, I think it's less risky to destroy the tapes and face the consequences than to let the American public or the American Congress see how sadistic these torture sessions were when they were carried out by the CIA. Remember, the FBI walked away from this interrogation program immediately when they saw what the CIA was doing. And the CIA was told by their FBI counterparts that this is wrong and it doesn't lead to good intelligence anyway, which anyone who's a professional in this field certainly knows.
No, in fact, I've interviewed Ali Soufflot, who was the FBI guy who finally went public with it and wrote an op-ed in the New York Times. And
I would worry about now is the matter is in the hands of the Inspector General of the CIA, and he's been a company man from the start. Remember, Obama really weakened the institution of the Inspector General at the CIA. He left the position vacant for nearly 2 years after an old colleague and friend of mine, John Helgerson, did a very good job as the IG. Obama appointed no one to CIA or to the State Department, for that matter. And then David Buckley became the Inspector General with no real background in this kind of intelligence work whatsoever. So it remains to be seen how vigorous the CIA is going to be in getting at the bottom of this. particularly when you have a professional advocate like John Brennan, who's going to defend the White House and defend his institution and not really get to the bottom of this. It's up to the Senate Intelligence Committee now to really be a junkyard dog in holding the CIA's feet to the fire.
Well, presumably what's going on here is that the CIA just simply doesn't want this report to come out. They've been stalling it for so long, it's pretty obvious.
What's in that report has to be so sensitive that they're not even willing to allow a sanitized version or a declassified version to appear. And if we had a courageous occupant in the White House, President Obama would say to the CIA, I want the executive summary sanitized and released immediately to end this. Let the American public know what went on. Let the American public know whether it was effective or not. And let's have some responsibility and accountability in this matter. And President Obama could get this overnight with an executive order.
Well, already John Brennan, the CIA director, has dismissed what Senator Feinstein said, saying that we wouldn't do that. I mean, that's just beyond the scope of reason in terms of what we would do. But on the other hand, the fact that, as you pointed out, Feinstein's been fairly cautious and not exactly, she's not taken any risks, shall we say, and hasn't really held their feet to the fire. The fact that she made a fairly strong speech and was actually fairly impressive to the point, you know, where others, for example, Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy has said that in his 40 years on the Senate, as a member of the Senate, this is the most important speech he's heard on the Senate floor in his 40 years as a member of the body. She, Feinstein, has spoken to our conscience now. Let's stand up for this country. So maybe this is going to, expand into a real movement here to hold their feet to the fire. What do you think?
It's possible that this could be a turning point. For one thing, there's bipartisan support. You mentioned Lindsey Graham. You've got people such as Senator Leahy, who has a lot of credibility among Democrats, of course, but also Republicans. You have Wyden and Udall being very active, and the new senator from New Mexico, Martin Heinrich, who at least is a new member to the committee, is clearly upset by what's happened, and I don't think Feinstein can walk away from this clash. For one thing, there's a federal act, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, that would make it a crime for the CIA to break into the Senate computers to look for the source of this review and how the Senate obtained it. And Brennan has restricted his remarks to computer fraud in terms of what he said the CIA wouldn't do, but it doesn't preclude that the CIA had a mole inside the committee. Because they do have a liaison person from the Congressional Affairs Office who's always been assigned to the committee, both the Senate and the House committees. Someone found out that the Senate had access to a very sensitive review. And I think the CIA is playing rhetorical games here by saying it wasn't an analytical work, it was just a summary of various documents. Well, it was a very sensitive summary that clearly dealt with torture and abuse, erroneous renditions, and the fact that probably innocent people were tortured along with people that the CIA had reason to believe knew something about terrorism. So this finally, after all of these years, because, you know, this goes back to 2006, really, when pressure was building to do something to stop torture and abuse, which even Bush finally stopped before Obama came into office. Obama then closed down the secret prisons, but he hasn't ended renditions. The rendition program is still on the books. I doubt if it's in much use because I don't think third world countries are willing to cooperate with us anymore. They were embarrassed about their involvement with these extraordinary renditions in the first place. So many European countries were taking part, and you had secret prisons all over the world, in Asia and Northern Africa and Eastern Europe. This could be a real turning point in finding out what happened in the global war on terror and how much unconscionable activity the CIA was engaged in.
Well, just in closing, Mel Goodman, back in a Senate Intelligence Committee hearing on November the 9th, Senator Udall asked CIA Director John Brennan directly whether the CIA was a party to the Computer Fraud Act that you referenced a little while ago, to which John Brennan replied, "I'll get back to you on that."
Yeah, I think that question had to make him extremely nervous, and that's why I think his response was limited to the field of computer fraud. It didn't preclude someone being a mole inside the Senate committee who informed the CIA that this very sensitive review was in their hands. This is what I think set off all of the alarm bells, because it contradicts everything not only that the CIA has been saying, but the White House has been saying about the nature of the renditions program and the torture and abuse. So this is incredibly provocative stuff.
But the president has shown that he wants to have really good relations with the CIA and essentially, you know, turn a blind eye because he feels he needs them in this so-called war on terror. Is that the problem?
He did the wrong thing from the very beginning when he said, "We're not going to look in the rearview mirror, we're going to look ahead." And I think with that, his total commitment to transparency, which was very important in the campaign in 2007-2008, really became an illusion once he was the president. So the historical record on this is not going to look good for the way Obama's handled whistleblowers, the way he's handled leaks, the way he's misused the Espionage Act against someone such as Thomas Drake. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And I think if the president were smart at this point, when really he's in the last few years of his second term and should be thinking about his legacy, he should remember his original commitment to liberty and to transparency and get to the bottom of this. And the easy way to do that is to release an executive summary of the Senate's report and to release the internal review, the 122-page review, and let the American people decide for themselves what went on, what was legal and what was illegal, and certainly what was immoral.
Well, Mel Goodman, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Melvin Goodman, who is a senior fellow at the Center on International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year government career included service at the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and the U.S. Army. In 1991, he was one of three former CIA officials to testify before the Senate against the nomination of Robert Gates as Director of Central Intelligence on the grounds that he had slanted intelligence to suit policy. He's the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, and his latest book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back discussing how much the oligarchs in the new Gilded Age are getting off lightly.
I'm more important in the USA than a spy for the FBI. I'm trained to meet the criminal elite and I seek out wherever evil resides.
My whole family, just keep your phony culture warm
and keep your f***ing tea.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Beverly Gage, a professor of history at Yale University and the author of The Day Wall Street Exploded, A Story of America in Its First Age of Terror. Her forthcoming book is G-Man, J. Edgar Hoover and the American Century. Welcome to Background Briefing, Beverly Gage.
Thanks, Ian.
And the New York Times have an editorial on Tuesday, "The Democrats Stand Up to the Kochs." And in effect, the New York Times is celebrating the fact that the Democrats have started to show some backbone and are fighting back against the Kochs, who apparently are trying to buy this next election to ensure that Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky becomes the majority leader. He's now the minority leader. And it appears that, you know, they're taking the gloves off and going to take the fight. And, of course, it's no coincidence that the entire night last night on the floor of the U.S. Senate was devoted to arguments about climate change, often directed at the Koch brothers, who, of course, fund climate change denial. So how do you see this battle working out?
Well, I think it's a little hard to say quite yet how it's going to work out. I think it is remarkable that the Democrats are beginning to mount this challenge. And as a historian, it really does make me think of what things looked like 100 years ago, a little more than that, back in the Gilded Age, when in fact kind of business control, particularly of state legislatures, but of the federal electoral process, inspired a huge wave of social protest and actually a lot of the first efforts at campaign finance reform, some of which we still have today and some of which have been scaled back over time. So I'm not sure how much this can happen from Washington alone, but the Democrats in Washington really responding to kind of grassroots pressure, that combination of things, I think, could make a pretty big change.
But you have written about comparing the current Gilded Age to the previous Gilded Age and have made the argument in Slate magazine in an interview and then also in an article, Radical Solutions to Economic Inequality, that in effect the plutocrats of today are getting off lightly compared to what happened back then.
They are. So that was my optimistic assessment, that maybe something really will come out of this latest round of protest. But I have to say, as a historian, what's been really striking about this economic crisis is, compared to almost any other moment of substantive economic crisis in the past, the people really have been very, very quiet. So if you go back to the late 19th century, you had labor battles, you had, in fact, members of what then would have been described as plutocrats. Today we might say the 1%, right? People were actually living in fear of a genuine revolution, of their lives being endangered. And the book that I wrote was about a bombing on Wall Street in 1920, and there were a lot of these sorts of events. So I'm not sure we want to go back to that, but compared to that moment, compared to the 1930s, even compared to the 1970s, it's been pretty striking how little protest there's actually been in response to both inequality and the economic crisis in particular.
Well, of course, there has been some protest from some plutocrats, some hedge fund managers in Silicon Valley,
right,
complaining about it being like Kristallnacht, you know.
Right. Yes, there have been, particularly in recent months, some rather over-the-top statements about the embattled 1% and how they are under siege in ways that evoke some of the darkest periods of human history. And this is a historian, I can assure them, actually, that they should stop worrying, because for better or worse, this is not actually the case right now.
Again, I'm speaking with Beverly Gage, who's a professor of history at Yale University and the author of The Day Wall Street Exploded, A Story of America in Its First Age of Terror. Her forthcoming book is G-Man, J. Edgar Hoover and the American Century. So back in the original Gilded Age, where William Jennings Bryan ran against McKinley, I believe outspending the Democrat something like 200-1, but the Democrat, of course, is famous in the Scopes trial for defending creationism. He was able to put together a coalition of rural and urban poor united around a kind of religious left, if you will. And, of course, now we're in the era of the religious right, and it makes one wonder at what point do you think in this current revival of the arguments over wealth and income inequality, whether or not there will be a moral and religious component emerging.
Yeah, I do think William Jennings Bryan is one of these very interesting figures to think about. So the election that you mentioned, the 1896 election in which William Jennings Bryan ran against McKinley, and really was one of these famous watershed elections, both because it was really the first major election in which, again, we can use the language of the late 19th century, plutocrats bought the election, but in which figures like J.P. Morgan, figures from Wall Street, really funneled their money to McKinley and vastly outspent William Jennings Bryan. So it's an interesting moment from that perspective, but it's interesting as well because William Jennings Bryan at that point, though I think today he is more famous for the Scopes trial, at that point he was sort of the standard bearer of populism. And what populism was in the late 19th century was, as you said, a kind of interracial class movement of primarily farmers, but other people as well, the urban working class to some degree anyway. And it put a lot of pressure on, and then it kind of failed as a movement. And so I think one of the questions that's sort of up for debate today is whether populism, this kind of grassroots anger directed at people in power, is primarily going to be coming from the right, something like the Tea Party, or if there's still space in American politics for these kind of genuine grassroots movements from the left. Occupy Wall Street was one example, but it kind of flared up and disappeared. And so I think that's one of the big open questions of our moment.
Well, the other question I would have, since I'm a member of the press, Beverly Gage, is that the Gilded Age, of course, ended with the Progressive Era, led by the accidental president, Teddy Roosevelt. They put him on the ticket, I guess, to balance the plutocrat. And then, of course, the plutocrat McKinley was shot shortly after its inauguration, I think. But one of the interesting aspects of the Progressive Era was the extent to which the press, particularly figures like Mark Twain and Ida Tarbell, were able to expose the malfeasance of the plutocrats and get all this stuff in print. That it led, of course, to breaking up, you know, the antitrust movement that broke up Standard Oil.
Yeah, there are a lot of people who are looking kind of hopefully at American politics and thinking that we're actually due up for a new progressive era. I mean, certainly someone like Bill de Blasio is saying that in New York, or Doris Kearns Goodwin, the historian, that's really what her new book is all about, The Rise of Muckraking, The Rise of Progressivism. And there's certainly a lot of room for it at this point. I mean, I do think the progressive era, one of the things that's notable about it is that you've got really sweeping changes in a lot of ways in American life. It actually, in the end, didn't make a big difference in terms of inequality. So the peak of inequality in the United States was actually the 1920s, and it was the Depression and the reforms of the 1930s, which came slightly later, that were one of the few moments when inequality actually shrank. So are we due up for a new progressive era? I think a lot of people are wondering if that might be coming, but we might want to think about whether the strategies of the progressive era were really the strategies that we want today.
Well, yesterday, Beverly Gage, I was speaking with Senator Bernie Sanders about the all-nighter that they're about to pull in the Senate and the possibility that he may run for president. And we talked about the historical record that we're discussing now of the ebbs and flows between the progressive eras and the regressive eras, if you like. And the conclusion was, of course, that this didn't happen by some, you know, divine logic. This happened because of leadership. And, of course, the point he was making was that leadership is extremely absent today, although, as we're discussing here, according to the New York Times editorial on Tuesday, there is an indication that this Senate, the Democrats may be standing up to the Koch brothers. But what's your sense then of the leadership vacuum? We talked about the press vacuum, and as much as we don't have muckrakers like Ida Tarbell, at least none that have certainly exposed the Koch brothers. But on the other point, we don't have FDR, we don't have Teddy Roosevelt. What's your sense of the political deficit?
Yeah, obviously figures like Teddy Roosevelt, like even Woodrow Wilson, and certainly Franklin Roosevelt, presidents are pretty important in this story. But I think it's also worth keeping in mind that all of them were responding as well to real pressure from below. So you look at a figure like Teddy Roosevelt, he sort of understands himself as a person who stands between the kind of threat of some larger working class revolution. This is, you know, before the Bolshevik Revolution. This is sort of the heyday of socialist utopianism. And he understood himself both to be kind of standing against that and bringing these reforms into an American system, but also standing against kind of plutocratic control, again, as he would have said. So I think presidents are obviously critically important. Leadership from Washington is critically important. But if you look at history, at either of the Roosevelts, certainly, they're really responding to pressure from below. And I think that it's very hard to lead when you don't have an organized social movement pushing you to really do this. This is something Franklin Roosevelt always liked to tell people is, I want to do this thing that you want me to do, whether it's labor legislation or securities regulation. Now go out there and make me do it. And so I think it's a complicated equation. I think it can't only come from Washington.
Well, just in closing then, Beverly Gage, some of the most trenchant critics of the current wealth and income inequality have been some of the billionaires. Bill Gates' father once said you can't sail two yachts at the same time. Warren Buffett has said we're in danger of becoming a plantation economy. It's odd that only from the extremely wealthy have we heard a lot of, leading this critique, if you will. Do you think that since the last Gilded Age, in the age of communications, et cetera, have the American people been sort of lulled into a kind of stupor, accepting? We have celebrity culture that worships wealth and fame. It seems as though we're a much more passive society than we were, particularly back when you wrote about the day Wall Street exploded.
I do think that there's a certain amount of truth to that critique, although I also think social protest and kind of what we see of social protest has also just changed in form to some degree. But I also think that actually even figures like Warren Buffett are continuing a kind of self-critique that came about in the Gilded Age, the first Gilded Age. So if you look at figures like Andrew Carnegie, if you look even to a certain degree at someone like John D. Rockefeller, though he's, I think, in many people's minds, really the kind of ultimate plutocrat of the Gilded Age, they actually had certain critiques of wealth and certain critiques of concentrations of wealth. A lot of that ended up being channeled through philanthropy, which, again, is something that you see happening among the 1% today. But I think that understanding that, in fact, the wealthy bear a certain burden for thinking through these questions, as well as the people in the other 99%, I think that, too, really is a legacy of the first Gilded Age.
Well, Beverly Gage, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
All right. Well, thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Beverly Gage, who's a professor of history at Yale University and the author of The Day Wall Street Exploded, A Story of America and Its First Age of Terror. Her forthcoming book is G-Man, J. Edgar Hoover and the American Century. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.